which is a series organized by the American and New England Studies Program. Our theme for this year is cultural politics, political culture. So it's a series that explores the way cultural works do political work and vice versa. And we're very pleased to have with us today a scholar whose work considers this whole question of the intersection of politics and culture, and that's Professor Yael Sternhell, who's an assistant professor of history and American studies at Tel Aviv University. Professor Sternhell is the author of a really wonderful and fascinating book called Roots of War, The World of Movement in the Confederate South. It was published in 2012 by Harvard University Press. And it very inventively takes the idea of mobility in the Civil War South and shows us how movement could both build up and also eventually help take down nationalism in the Confederacy. Roots of War, I should say, too, was a finalist for the 2013 Lincoln Prize. It was also the winner of the Francis B. Simpkins Award for Best First Book in Southern History. And today, Professor Sternhell will talk about the archive and the making of sectional reconciliation, 1865 to 1880. I'm going to just say, too, I think it's especially fitting that she's speaking to us on the 150th anniversary of the day after the Gettysburg Address. So please join me in welcoming Professor Sternhell.
All right. Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here, and thank you so much, Brooke and Nina, for setting this up, and of course, Becky for helping make this happen. I'm delighted to be here and delighted to be part of this series on political culture and or cultural politics. And indeed, the story that I will be telling today is fundamentally about the archive as a nexus between the politics and culture of the postbellum era. As I hope to show in this talk, political calculations and cultural forces fuse to shape the history of the Confederacy's written record at the same time that they were deeply influenced by the existence of that record in its various guises and forms. The history of the Confederate archive in the postwar era cannot be written as either political or cultural, only as both. It is embedded in several dominant cultural strands, reconciliation, record-keeping, historical thinking, as well as in the political realignments of the era spanning the mid and late 19th century. One of the questions that I am grappling with in working on this project, both the piece that I will present here and the overall story, is how precisely do politics and culture work together? What are the boundaries between them? How do political interests and agendas create cultural sensibilities? And how does culture feed into politics? How do these two realms, abstract and concrete at the same time, play out in the minds of 19th century Americans involved in the project of creating and maintaining a national archive for a nation that doesn't exist? So, in 1901, the federal government published the final volume in the War of the Rebellion, a compilation of the official records of the Union and Confederate armies, the OR, a collection of documents culled from the vast body of paperwork generated by the armies who fought in the Civil War. Comprising 128 volumes, averaging 900 pages each, the collection had been in the making for nearly four decades and had cost the government millions of dollars. In honor of the project's successful completion, the last installment included a celebratory introduction by Secretary of War Elihu Root, there he is, who recounted the story of the OR's making. Root gratefully acknowledged ex-Confederates who helped complete the collection, singling out no other than the former president of the Confederate States of America, Jefferson Davis, and his widow, who afforded the government access to his papers relating to the late war, and from this source were obtained copies of archives of the greatest historical value. To allay any concerns as to how Davis's precious contributions were handled, Root assured his readers that the department had employed ex-Confederate officers to assist in the compilation of the Confederate archives to represent Confederate interests and to assure impartiality. Root's efforts to present the OR as an unbiased and bisectional were very much in tune with the popular trend of national reconciliation. As the federal government was churning out volume after volume of wartime records, it was creating the first national military parks and funding blue-gray reunions on the anniversaries of important battles. In popular culture, rightists, artists, and journalists of all hues were publishing highly romanticized and deeply nostalgic portrayals of the Old South and the war for its independence. In universities, historians were crafting narratives that presented the Civil War as an unfortunate but unavoidable stage in the evolution of the United States as a modern nation, attributing some blame to both sides. And I obviously feel a little ridiculous reciting this in the presence of Nina Silver, whose work is foundational in this area. But even more importantly, Root's introduction was no mere gesture to the spirit of the age, but an actual, an actual reflection of the philosophy behind the OR. Indeed, the War of the Rebellion is a thoroughly bipartisan compilation. It avoids the political questions of the war altogether, presenting the conflict as a purely military affair. The volumes are organized spatially and temporally, moving between one campaign and the next, from one theater of operations to the other. Union and Confederate records appear side by side. This is a sample of a page. You can't really see it that well, but that's pretty much what it looks like. Each army telling its own version of any given event. Documents appear in their original form without any additional commentary or context, allowing historical actors on both sides to speak for themselves. As the staunchly pro-Confederate historian Douglas Southall Freeman noted in 1939, the only fact to indicate that they were issued by the victors was that the Union reports and correspondence always preceded the Confederate. Yet the curious fact is that while the compilation was completed in 1901, the first volume of the OR was sent to the printer in 1880. The major archival and editorial decisions that shaped the collection were made even earlier, during the stormy 1870s, when sectional animosities still ran high and when former Confederates often still seemed like open enemies of the federal government. The very name of the collection, War of the Rebellion, harks back to a time when secession was considered an illegal insurgency and hints that the story of the OR is longer and more complicated than it may seem. This is a story well worth telling. In many ways, the OR have constituted the basis for Civil War scholarship. Even today, when a wide selection of primary sources is available online, the OR continue to serve virtually every scholar working on any aspect of the sectional conflict, including historians of culture, society, and politics. It is impossible to overstate the contribution of this corpus to the historiography of the Civil War era and to the public memory of the nation's bloodiest war. Despite the crucial place of the OR in the writing on American history, the compilation has garnered little scholarly attention. The fundamental questions about the collection and its relationship with post-war Union have remained largely unanswered. When and why did the Confederate version of the Civil War enter into a history published by the federal government? How did the collection's deeply nonpartisan character materialize? Was it merely a reflection of the broader culture of reconciliation or a driving force in its emergence? How did the process of collecting, classifying, and publishing the sources bear on this unique historical and political enterprise? The absence of answers to these queries is all the more striking considering the profound impact of the archival turn on the humanities. As Anne Laura Stoller aptly notes, among historians, literary critics, and anthropologists, archives have been elevated to new analytic status with distinct billing worthy of scrutiny of their own. The shift, as Stoller defines it, from archive as source to archive as subject, was deeply influenced by Michel Foucault's 1972 Archaeology of Knowledge and by Jacques Derrida's 1996 Archive Fever. Both thinkers offered highly abstract inquiries into the idea of the archive, challenging its actuality as a repository of documents or artifacts, and advancing new interpretations of the archive as a discursive or psychological construct. These meditations, combined with an explosion of interest in the mechanisms and meanings of information gathering and exchange, have inspired historians to rethink the nature and significance of the archive. For several decades now, scholars from a range of disciplines have been asking how archives work to produce knowledge rather than merely preserve it, how collecting, storing, and cataloging documents has empowered certain political and social entities at the expense of others, and how archives have given prominence to the stories of majorities and elites while obliterating the memory of subalterns. The archive, in short, is widely recognized as both formative and reflective of cultural, social, and political power. The Civil War is no exception. The great national crisis of 1861 to 1865 famously created mass armies of citizen soldiers, but it also created mass bureaucracies of citizens' clerks, like this guy, or these guys. In the aftermath of the conflict, the victorious government was left with a gargantuan body of paperwork, including the records of its defeated enemy. While those records were first considered as contraband of war, they eventually became a crucial element in the process of forging a national consensus about the past and carving a new path for America's future. From 1865 to 1880, the government's Confederate collection formed a focal point of the complex and shifting relationship between the losers and winners of the American Civil War. The importance of capturing the Confederacy's official papers was clear to the high command of the Union Army as soon as victory became a fact. On April 5, 1865, 3 days after the first columns of United States troops marched into Richmond, Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton instructed the commanding officer in the city to secure all the letters, papers, and correspondence in the post office and other departments at Richmond and transmit them to Mr. Seward. In the early days of Union occupation, not many paid heed to the department's instructions regarding Confederate records. But then came the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Shocked and enraged, Northerners largely assumed that the Confederate government had been part of the conspiracy and that additional plots might be underway. Suddenly, collecting and sorting through Confederate records became a critically important task. The Army appointed Colonel Richard D. Cutts as keeper of the public archives and ordered rooms in the customs house cleared for storage of captured records. Despite the wealth of paperwork in his charge, Colonel Cutts warned his superiors that he was sending mostly debris, as the truly valuable material had been carried off before the evacuation of Richmond, and most of what was left behind had been destroyed during the fire or plundered by relic hunters. Regardless, on May 11th, the officer in command of the forces in Richmond expressed hope that among the documents may be found much evidence in regards to plots of assassination, incendiarism, treason, etc. 2 days later, General John M. Schofield discovered the records of the Confederate War Department hidden in Charlotte, North Carolina. Under orders to send the papers immediately for use in the present trials and to preserve every paper, however unimportant it may appear, Schofield sent to Washington 81 boxes weighing 10 tons. By late June, the federal government had become the custodian of several hundred boxes, barrels, mailbags, and hogsheads of Confederate papers sent from all over the South. The challenge was to sort through them as quickly as possible and find incriminating evidence against Confederate officials who were going to be put on trial for complicity in the assassination of Abraham Lincoln and other treasonous acts. On July 21, 1865, the War Department officially established a bureau for the collection, safekeeping, and publication of the rebel archives that have come into the possession of the government. And what we have here, and we can't really see it very well, is a stamp of the rebel archives. And that stamp will remain the federal government's standard stamp for all papers belonging or stored in the rebel archives late into the 19th century. And that's interesting for reasons that I hope we will soon understand. But when you do a project about archives, you really have to get interested in pretty small things, and stamps are one of them. So,
where is the stamp?
How do you It's this, yeah. It says Rebel Archives, War Department. Okay, we'll have more stamps later on, so fear not. After some debate, Stanton appointed the renowned legal scholar, Dr. Francis Lieber, as chief of the new bureau. Lieber, who migrated to the United States from Germany in 1827, was a professor of law at Columbia College in New York and the author of the hugely important General Order No. 100, the Union Army's Code of Conduct. The war had also been a deeply personal affair for him. All three of his sons fought in the war, including his beloved eldest son, Oscar, who supported the Confederacy and died in its service in 1862. Taking charge of the piles of paperwork arriving from the field, Lieber embarked on the mammoth task of sorting through hundreds of thousands of documents and finding the smoking guns that would support the federal government's legal cases against the leaders of the rebellion. Yet despite his best intentions, the Archive Office yielded virtually nothing in the way of incriminating evidence against the Confederate leadership. The case against Jefferson Davis gradually disintegrated until officially dismissed in February 1869, and other proceedings did not even result in an indictment. Yet despite the urgency and gravity of the Rebel Archives' legal mission, it was not the only justification for its existence. From the outset, Union officials were also thinking about the Archive Office as a repository for the history of the war, expressing hope that the papers will prove of great value to those who may hereafter write the history of this great rebellion, as one of them said. Stanton had the same notion. He appointed Lieber since he was a legal scholar with acute historical sensibilities, the right man for a job that combined both legal and historical uses of paperwork. Indeed, as he toiled in the hot rooms of the Archive Office, poring over mounds of papers covered in Richmond street dirt, the historical significance of the work he was doing was never far from Lieber's mind. He assumed that the archives would eventually be open for proper use by the student of history, as he wrote, and urged the government to publish the most important records, which were of great value for the formation of a correct opinion on the struggle for the integrity of our country, the national character of our government, and the extinction of disintegrating state sovereignty, as well as slavery. Having given up on locating innumerable records lost in the war, he sought to complete the archives' holdings with state records, newspapers, and congressional publications. The organization of the records was done with a view of their classification for reference and publication, including abstracting, indexing, and cross-referencing between different collections. He welcomed the possibility of receiving in the office the wartime papers of the Union Army as well, and its transformation into a general American war archives. Thus, even if the documents housed in the Rebel Archives did not make for sufficient proof in court, they had an equally vital role as irrefutable historical evidence for posterity. In that sense, the legal and historical functions of the Rebel Archives were intricately entwined. Both derived from the Union's determination to exact retribution from Southerners for the catastrophe they had inflicted on the nation. Both reflected the prevalent mood in the North at the close of the Civil War and the expectation that the post-war period would be a time of legal and historical account settling. Francis Lieber, one of his era's foremost thinkers on questions of morality, law, and history, was devoted to both undertakings. Having realized that the government's legal initiative was losing momentum, he tried to use the papers collected and cataloged under his watch to showcase those offenses that could not be tried in court, but would perhaps be judged by history. Thus, for the first 2 years of its existence, with a bitter and combative Francis Lieber at its head, the Archive Office served as a clearinghouse of Confederate culpability and a ready vehicle of revenge. Lieber was relieved from duty in the Archive Office on August 17, 1867. The various secretaries occupying the War Department during the late 1860s did not appoint a new chief for the office, a clear sign of its diminishing importance during those years. Day-to-day operations were left in the hands of the chief clerk, Bezaliel Wells. The office continued to handle mostly legal matters, furnishing the government with evidence for the slew of lawsuits filed by civilians in loyal states for property they lost to the government during the war. The Archive Office was thrust back to the center of post-war legal deliberations with the establishment in 1871 of two claims commission. The Southern Claims Commission, a three-man panel for judging claims by Southerners who had remained loyal to the government but fell victim to the Union's confiscation policies, and the Commission on American and British Claims, which began its work following the Treaty of Washington between England and the United States. The Rebel Archives turned out to be a crucial resource for both commissions, saving the government, by the office's own estimates, many millions of dollars. The clerks worked diligently with lists of names sent by the commissions, digging up obscure documents, comparing signatures, and preparing briefs against individuals who were suing the government for damages, but were actually on record as having supported the Confederacy. By 1874, the Archive Office had established itself as a highly useful organ of the federal government in its post-war scuffles with Southerners, now taking place in courtrooms instead of battlefields. The Rebel Archives were finally living up to their potential as a treasure trove of incriminating information about the South. Yet precisely at that moment, ironically, the federal government's archival enterprise was about to be entirely transformed. From a tool of legal retribution, it would morph into an early and effective instrument of national reconciliation. On June 23, 1874, Congress passed an amendment to an appropriation bill allocating $15,000 to enable the Secretary of War to begin the publication of the official records of the War of the Rebellion, both of the Union and of the Confederate armies. This was not the first time lawmakers in Washington discussed the possibility of making public the documentary record of the Civil War. A decade earlier, on April 21st, 1864, Senator Henry Wilson of the great Commonwealth of Massachusetts, chairman of the Committee on Military Affairs, introduced a joint resolution requiring the Secretary of War to print all reports, dispatches, and telegrams relating to the movements, engagements, and operations generally of the armies of the United States. Wilson was acting on a request by Henry W. Halleck, the Army's chief of staff and master bureaucrat, who was struggling to keep up with the vast piles of paperwork generated by the Union's massive war machine. After the resolution was passed, Wilson received some useful advice from Joseph Hutton DeFries, the superintendent of public printing, who suggested, among other things, that the collection would be arranged chronologically, that its volumes not exceed 800 pages each, and that it be accompanied by an index. A revised resolution was approved on May 19, 1864, and work on the compilation began immediately under the supervision of another Civil War officer no one has heard of, Edward D. Townsend, then the Army's Assistant Adjutant General. By next summer, Townsend had finished preparing 8 volumes, but they were a far cry from the original plan. The collection consisted solely of the official reports submitted by the Army's commanding officers and excluded all other pertinent material. When DeFries received the volumes, he refused to print them. With the end of the war in April 1865, the project ceased to be a pressing matter for the military, but in May 1866, Congress took up the issue again. By then, the context and meaning of publishing a documentary record of the Civil War had radically changed. While easily accessible records of battles and campaigns were still useful as an instructional and organizational resources, other considerations were now in play. In the time that had elapsed, the Civil War had transmuted from present into past. The Union Army's operations were no longer an urgent challenge requiring careful management through written records, but a glorious history in need of a reliable and permanent account. Furthermore, in 1866, the government was also in possession of Confederate records stored in our archive office. With memories of the conflict still fresh and relations with the South as strained as they have ever been, Congress approached the question of how to deal with the mammoth collection of documents left from the war. The debate in the Senate about the publication project reflected the new importance of paperwork in the post-war era. Now that the war was over and the extent of the written records it produced became clear, the task at hand seemed much more daunting. The material already received by the Superintendent of Public Printing was so vast and in part of such doubtful historical value, as Wilson said, it was necessary to rethink the whole matter. So Wilson, once again, the driving force behind the legislation, emphasized the absolute necessity of the work being well edited if it were to be of real historical value and worthy of the country. He called for the appointment of some competent person of ability and literary experience familiar with such work, i.e., not Townsend, and suggested to organize the material not simply chronologically, but in a way that would enable easy reference. In stark contrast to the 1864 discussion, which was brief and technical, this time the burden of history was clearly on the senator's mind. They considered possible schemes and probable costs, questioning whether such a great undertaking was even feasible and whether any of them would live to see it brought to completion. They debated how the material should be organized, who should serve as compiler, and what editorial methods should be used. While some senators were deeply hesitant to approve such an expensive and unwieldy project, the chamber agreed to repeal the 1864 decision so to prevent the publication of Townsend's substandard work and sent the entire matter back to committee where a new plan could be devised. The discussion that day also touched on whether Confederate records should be published too. Wilson started out by saying that the collection should comprise and authentic records of the deeds of the loyal armies and find its way as such into every library at home and abroad and mold the judgment of history. Yet as senators delved into the intricacies of the archival process, the debate shifted course. When the influential William P. Fessenden brought up the matter of the Confederate records, the question at hand was not the glorification of the Union, but the compilation of a comprehensive history of the war. Both Fessenden and Henry B. Anthony, a former journalist who had served twice as chairman of the Committee of Printing, were strongly in favor. Fessenden stipulated that Confederate and Union records on the same subjects ought to be printed in juxtaposition so that the whole subject matter might be seen. Republican senators, otherwise immersed in the political battles of Reconstruction, considered the publication of Confederate records from an archival point of view. If the purpose of a long and costly publication project was first and foremost to offer a credible history of the war, both sides needed to be represented. Curiously, even Wilson, who evidently saw the collection as a way to commemorate the Northern War effort, ended up concurring that Confederate records should be part of the compilation. Despite the interest senators showed in the project, and perhaps because they now had a fuller grasp of its real scale, Congress never moved ahead to appropriate funding for the compilation of the war records. The matter remained stalled, and requests by Secretary of War William W. Belknap to receive money for the project fell on deaf ears. Finally, in June 1874, the House of Representatives appropriated the modest sum of $15,000 in an amendment to a sundry civil expenses bill. The decision to appropriate money seems to have resulted from a combination of circumstances: the pressure of veteran groups, the interest of politicians like Belknap and James A. Garfield, who had also served as officers in the Union Army, and a palpable sense that the passage of time was endangering the invaluable records slowly decaying in government buildings. Indeed, 1874 was a moment when the war still felt close enough to evoke powerful emotions, yet it was also starting to recede into memory. In the House debate that led to the appropriation, Representative John Coburn of Indiana, another Civil War veteran, warned that the records are now in buildings where they are liable any day to be destroyed by fire or other accident. They are liable to be abstracted or lost, and thus a most important part of the history of the country may at any time, for want of proper protection of these records, be utterly annihilated. Once again, the logic of the archive exerted itself on decision makers. Yet this time, early signs of sectional detente were also on display. Everybody in the land, continued Coburn, whether he may have been engaged on one side or another in the conflict. Every lover of this country, everyone who delights in the preservation of its history, is interested in this matter. Despite the conciliatory spirit behind these remarks, the legislation fixed the title of the collection as the Official Records of the War of the Rebellion. Rebellion was the word used in the North to describe the war in the South while it was still going on. In the linguistic culture of the era, it was a highly charged and unabashedly partisan term. There was no debate on how to call the collection, the word rebellion being a natural choice in a majority Republican Congress still preoccupied with the aftermath of the war. The 1874 appropriation, small as it was a crucial turning point in the history of the rebel archives. The new commitment to publishing the records transformed their very nature from legal documents used primarily to establish the disloyalty of Southerners to a historical corpus slated to form part of a national monument for the war. While Confederate records were still stored in a separate archive, from this moment on, they would be managed in conjunction with Union paperwork in preparation for the publication of both. Almost immediately, it became evident that the bureaucratic necessities created by the decision to publish the records were going to have a transformative impact on the relationship between the government and its former enemies. Sectional reconciliation would have some of its early beginnings in the mid-1870s in the federal venture of publishing the written record of the war. In the wake of the decision, the War Department reorganized its record-keeping apparatus, creating a new entity called the War Records Office and placing it in charge of the publication project. Belknap transferred most of the responsibility from the taciturn Townsend to his chief clerks, who were busy but were at least more excited about the task. The greatest challenge facing the clerks was the disparity in size between its federal and Confederate holdings. If the collection was to present both sides of the conflict, the space allocated to each had to be, if not identical, at least similar. The department was aware of the fact that the solution rested with the stockpiles of Confederate documents scattered around the South in the homes of individuals and in the archives of private society. Nominally, these records were the property of the federal government, yet that did not mean very much in practice. As Belknap acknowledged in his annual report to Congress in 1875, it seems impossible to obtain the information necessary to their recovery through the courts or otherwise than by purchase. As no appropriation for the mass purchase of records had been made, the only remaining option was negotiating with ex-Confederates to give or loan their private papers to the government that had been their sworn enemy for 4 long years. The task of cajoling Southerners into handing over their records was further complicated by the fact that relations between former rebels and the War Department were notoriously bad. For years, ex-Confederates had tried to gain access to the documents kept in the archive office, most of the time to no avail. Outside parties were generally barred from the office, and in order for a search to be conducted by the clerical staff, an applicant needed both connections and luck. Beyond a habit of secrecy and lingering animosity towards the South, the rebel archives had become a crucial resource for the federal government, its only shield against tens of thousands of claims filed by Southerners during the 1870s. The result was that most applications for papers from the archives were refused. The unavailability of Confederate records was a source of immense frustration for Southerners devoted to studying and commemorating the history of the Civil War. This was by no means the majority of ex-Confederates. In the years immediately the war, Southern whites were preoccupied with rebuilding their lives in a radically altered social, political, and economic environment. While memorial activities for Confederate dead began during the war and continued in its aftermath, most men and women involved in the Confederate war effort were eager to set aside the trauma of defeat and move on. Nevertheless, amidst what sometimes seemed like willful forgetfulness, a few stepped forward as professional gatekeepers of the Confederate past. In 1869, a group of former officers founded the Southern Historical Society, an organization dedicated to the preservation and propagation of the Confederate version of the war. The Society began collecting documents for what was essentially a competing enterprise to the Archive Office, and in 1876 launched its own publication project, the Southern Historical Society Papers. While often struggling financially and with little popular following, the Southern Historical Society aspired to gain ownership of the Confederate historical records. Its zealous executives were infuriated by the fact that a great store of papers was hidden away in Washington and deeply suspicious of the use the Archive Office was making of its holdings. The Southern Historical Society papers recounted how Robert E. Lee tried in vain to get access to his own battle reports and field returns, and how the Executive Department of the State of Virginia had been rudely refused to see or have copied its own records. The rebel archives were both a source of constant humiliation and an impediment to the Southern attempt to vindicate itself through the writing of history. The new momentum for the publication project upended the balance of power between the Archive Office in Washington and the Southern Historical Society in Richmond. Belknap appointed one of his senior clerks, William T. Barnard, to examine the rebel archives and ordered that all printers at work on the OR would be employed printing the Southern records. Most crucially, Belknap issued an official order mandating parity of federal and Confederate records in the volumes under preparation. On August 17, 1875, his chief clerk conveyed the secretary's wish that the rebel archives should be prepared for publication under the Act of June 23, 1874, pari passu with the federal records now being prepared for publication. Belknap followed up on the order with a letter to the Southern Historical Society quoted in the New York Times. He expressed his desire to secure every official report, letter, telegram, or order emanating from others either side during the late war, and promised that he had no thought whatever of discriminating in favor of one section as against another in their publication. The Southern Historical Society was not impressed. The Society's indefatigable secretary, J. William Jones, thanked Belknap and spoke of a general disposition to aid the government in the publication project, as there had been a widespread fear at the South that few of the captured Confederate records would ever see the light, and a general feeling that their suppression and a refusal to give access to them would be a great wrong to the cause of truth and justice. However, Jones offered the Society's cooperation on the condition of reciprocity. "We will have furnished you properly authenticated copies of such as are in our possession, and will assist you in procuring others, it being understood, of course, that your department will afford us similar facilities in the prosecution of our work." Neither the written exchanges nor a face-to-face meeting with Barnard effected a change. The SHS refused to open its files to the War Department unless allowed access to the documents in the rebel archives. Further attempt to cajole the Society in 1876 and 1877 turned out to be a failure. As long as full reciprocity was not guaranteed, Southern record keepers refused to budge. Thus, by December 1877, despite the War Department's renewed interest in the publication project and additional appropriations totaling $125,000, little progress had been made. At that point, Secretary of War George W. McCrary decided to appoint someone who would take charge of the project and will have no other duties in the War Department. That person turned out to be Robert N. Scott, a lawyer and career officer in the Army who had filled a range of administrative positions and was well acquainted with Civil War paperwork. Scott was an interesting choice for another reason. Born in Tennessee and raised in Louisiana, he was arrested in the beginning of the Civil War for voicing pro-Southern opinions in public. Yet after that incident, he served honorably and was a close aide to Halleck both during and after the war. He embraced the opportunity to serve as chief of the War Records Office and embarked on the work of compilation with tremendous rigor and method. We don't have a picture of this incredibly important guy because it at least doesn't exist through, you know, the usual means of finding pictures, which says something about what we actually know about him and about his place in history. But we'll surely get to that later. Scott revolutionized the War Records Office by creating the system that had been missing for so long and by structuring the volumes so they could be conveniently used for historical reference. He set clear and consistent standards for which types of documents would be included and which would not, and decided that the volumes would be divided into the familiar 4 series. He made the critical decision that all documents pertaining to a particular event would be arranged together and that events would be grouped according to the campaigns they were part of. Lastly, he abolished the separation between federal and Confederate records. By all means, he wrote the Secretary of War in his first report, the Union and Confederate accounts of any events should be given in the same volume.